Hello, check it out, Canada. This is the doctor.
Yo, this is Slim Kid.
And this is Fat Lip.
This is Imani.
This is the Far Side.
That's who we are. Yo, check it out. We're just chilling. You know what I'm saying? Yo, Imani, what station are we on?
CKUT
90.3
FM. Cool it.
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
I'll pull up the script.
And welcome to Labor Radio. I'm your host, Mustafa Henaway, always here with
Stefan Doucette. You can hear us every third Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, or CKUT.ca online. Also hear us on our Mixcloud page, where you can find archives. You can find that through our Facebook page, Labor Radio on Facebook.
And on today's show, it is our special hot take leading up to May 1st, International Workers' Day. And in this episode, we're going to talk about several issues that are a bit more in-depth and a bit more our perspective on some debates and issues that are pertinent to the labor movement. But we're going to start off first with the Public Service Alliance of Canada's unlimited strike of 155,000 members. We're also going to talk about the question of labor internationalism and some of the issues pertaining the sort of the link between right-wing nationalism and labor protectionism that's been surfacing around particularly certain industries and certain sectors. We're also going to talk about the role of inter-union, what's called rigging, or the right for workers to actually to choose their unions and some of the issues around that. And we're going to end on a discussion of we're going to end on a discussion of what's the role of activists within trade unions and pertaining certain maybe political issues that relate to unions and particularly the role of who to organize and who not to organize and how to deal with some of those issues.
Before we get going, I just wanted to say you can also find us on the Labor Radio Podcast Network. So no guests today, just me and Mustafa. Before we get to our hot take machine, we just wanted to take a quick music break. And after that, you're going to hear our worst and best takes of the year.
International team. 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 International team.
Okay, welcome back, Labor Radio here on CKUT. As we mentioned in the introduction, we're going to speak about the PSAC strike, obviously. Started yesterday on the 19th, 155,000 federal workers. The hot take here is not like a steaming hot. It's just that we've barely spoken about this. I think last time that we mentioned it, we expressed a great amount of skepticism about whether they would strike or not. Turns out they are. So we were maybe a bit off about that. But I guess one thing you can say about it is the federal government's just not willing to give anywhere resembling inflation raises to the public service, which is interesting in and of itself, because as we were discussing before we started the show, they're giving money to all kinds of people. I mean, there was CERB for regular workers, but most importantly, there was the wage subsidy for big corporations, which cost the taxpayers billions upon billions. Those billions are not going to the public service, though. It seems like that on the question of wages is the biggest issue. I mean, most people who watch TV, listen to the radio, have seen ads. I mean, they're on YouTube. We're trying to watch soccer highlights. You got to sit through a PSAC ad. I'm joking, but the fact is they've been working really hard to sort of prepare the public for their wage demands, most of all. So I know that remote work is an issue. There's probably lots of other issues. I think wages are central, though.
And I mean, what's really interesting is obviously that the federal government, Trudeau, has essentially signaled that this should end swiftly. So I mean, while they haven't tabled back to work legislation, it's very clear, you know, what we've seen before, especially with the postal workers, is that the strong arm of the government is obviously, I think, going to come pretty quickly to force these workers.
But the thing to note here, and this is what they've been talking about on the radio a lot that I've heard, is who's going to... They're a minority government. They can't, just on the strength of their own party, push through back-to-work legislation. NDP's not going to do it. The Bloc Québécois is not going to do it. Who does that leave? Is Poiliev going to help legislate back-to-work to federal workers? Possibly. It's not really his best look if he's trying to, you know, he's been playing this card about inflation and monetary policy and yada yada. I mean, it's maybe a sacrifice he's willing to make for, you know, because he intends to be the next government and he doesn't want higher wages for the public service. Obviously, ideologically, that's not his wheelhouse, but, you know, it's a tough game to play. And so the Liberals are, for the moment, probably shopping around to see who's going to buy them the extra votes to force the workers back to work. But it's not as obvious as it has been in the past. When the last time that they did back-to-work legislation for the port workers in Montreal, they had a majority government. It's not the case anymore.
No, and I mean, the inflation question is really important, right? Because essentially what it is that you're lowering. If you're not willing to match inflation, you're essentially going to say, we're going to lower your wages, right? It's like, the federal government is going to essentially decrease the public sector's wages, right? So it's a pretty strong precedent, I think, for everybody if these federal workers don't actually win, right? It will be, I think, catastrophic for the labor movement, right? And sort of the fears of, oh, what if workers sort of demand wages above inflation. This is going to set what they call a wage price spiral, and that things will, you know, just ultimately, you know, get out of control, and we won't be able to control it. It's very clear that the money is there, and that to that language is ultimately, it's part of a bigger, and I think economists, other capitalists aren't even afraid to use the language. They'll say it's class war, right? And this is kind of the moment we're in. So it's not just that it's historic within PSAC, but actually, this is, you know, a sort of unwritten way of saying we're going to go back to an era of price control, right? And essentially, you know, we saw this in the 70s where there was the, you know, even the commission on price control and sort of which limited unions' ability to actually to bargain. You know, there was the Great General Strike. I think it was 74 or 76. So, you know, this, I think the struggle around PSAC, it's not just a bunch of, you know, lazy bureaucrats and you know, what a lot of what they try to hit at these workers. This is actually a pretty symbolic, significant strike, I think, for everybody. I mean, this is, and not just about improving services or improving the conditions of workers, but this is going to have a ripple effect across, you know, the labor market, right? So it's, I think to me, it's pretty significant. Also, I think the other thing, the hot take for me is yeah, everyone was quite skeptical, right? This is like the state of the affairs. If, you know, PSAC is actually willing to go on strike, a union that rarely uses that tool, then you know things are getting bad for workers, right? If they're willing to do this, they know that there's not much other options left, right? And that members are pissed, and that inflation is a real issue for working people now.
Absolutely. I mean, if you needed further proof of that, but it's true that, you know, almost, what is it? Yeah, 155,000 workers is not something to laugh at. And I mean, when you talk about sort of setting a benchmark for negotiations going forward, let's not forget that there's big ass public sector negotiations going on in Quebec right now. And so you can be sure that this will have an effect on that. And what would be interesting is if the public workers in Quebec had an effect on the federal one as well, instead of just going from federal to provincial. I mean, there's lots of reasons why, like, the timelines might not match up in a way that really, that they can feed off of each other in a particular way. Because public sector workers in Quebec, their contract just expired not even a month ago, and now begins this long period of negotiating the sort of framework of the strike possibilities, because this is all very judicial at this point. It goes through the courts to determine how they can strike, with how much services that they have to manage. Since they do run like healthcare facilities, they can't all walk out and whatever. So anyways, the stuff that I've heard from the provincial level, from the Front Commun in Quebec, is that there's not likely to be much strikes until summer, even late summer. But that's not to say that there won't be struggle before that, because now there's les moyens de pression are also legal. Like, they can do other things than just strike. So we've been seeing t-shirts and demonstrations, but I know that they can manage more than that.
No, I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in the coming days, and like whether, I mean, how long the strike will go. This is the second day. It is an unlimited strike, and I think are picket lines across the city. And I mean, I think what's interesting too is that that, you know, their members are still willing to offer key services still to so AI, things like that. So it's not like they're shutting down fully, right? So there's still things that are necessary for people who really need access to certain federal services. They're willing to keep going, right? So it's so I think it's really worth you know, people going out to these picket lines if they can, because also it's one of those ways that I think we're going to talk about later is that how do we, you know, build a kind of a radical labor movement, right? And it's not going to be the kind of moral judging that, you know, that the mainstream media does on these workers, right? It's actually building solidarity from below, right? So it's if people can go, you know, out to those picket lines and show support, I think it makes an invaluable difference, right?
Absolutely. Well, maybe on that note, let's take a quick music break and we'll come back with some spicier stuff after that. We'll be right back.
welcome back to Labor Radio. And one thing, you know, worth having a hot take in a discussion is, you know, on the same logic is corporate handouts by both the federal and provincial government. So one of the things recently has been the decision by Olymel to close its major pork processing plant in Beauce region and Vallée Jonction, unionized by CSN. You know, we're talking about 1,000 workers, also including a large portion of temporary foreign workers. And Olymel actually had received $155 million subsidy from the provincial government to modernize its plants and keep jobs in Quebec. And here we have a whole community now that's just going to be devastated. It's going to be like a tsunami, because with the closure, it's not just those jobs. We're talking about 1,000 jobs. We're talking about people's families. Now we're talking about pork producers and farmers also in the region who are going to be deeply affected. So we're talking about a small community that's going to be ravaged while the government handed them the money to be able to do this. So again, sort of the hot take is that CAC is obviously no friend of working people, and also this sort of rhetoric about the regions and is really, you know, it's a political ruse, right? You know, CAC's allies are still the CEOs, right? In the boardrooms. It's not the region. So it's, I think, to me, what's really interesting, and I know the union is hard hit, but, you know, again, this is a discussion, but I mean, it means, like, really thinking through these things is, like, you know, how come there's no movement, you know, to say, you know, keep the plant open, right? And I think that would really undermine CAC at this moment, right? Because it would win over people in a region that is, that had voted CAC, right? But I think we don't think about these things. And unfortunately, going into maybe some of our other topics of the day about strategizing when it comes to the question of labor.
Well, yeah, and I just wanted to add a bit on the Vallée Jonction. They were on strike for quite a while recently. They're on a new contract with some significant gains. What I heard was that they were justifying this in that they couldn't make an agreement with the Union des Producteurs Agricoles on the price of pork. Anyways, the other thing I heard was that this plant, for every job it has, generates about 3 jobs in the area. So you're looking at, you know, between 3,000 and 4,000 people losing work. And I mean, we need to talk about plant closure legislation, you know, because it's totally insane that you would be, I mean, it's not insane from a point of view of the ruling class, but as a working class movement, how can we accept that the government would give this amount of money and that we wouldn't get anything out of it except for lost jobs and a devastated community? You know, right now, I think we're in the final stages of a law that guarantees that in the case of a corporate bankruptcy, the pensions come first before the payments to shareholders. And this, to me, is like maybe a bit of, it could be a first step towards, you know, another similar legislation around plant closures. So Olymel is anything except bankrupt. So that's not the issue. It's not the pensions. We're talking about jobs and we're talking about infrastructure. These things are as important to working people as their pensions, you know? So there's no reason to me that we can't, as this legislation comes in, say, okay, well, what's the next step? And this is kind of an obvious one to me. There's been plant closures across the country. Especially since free trade, which maybe brings us to our next topic. I mean, because this is something that we wanted to talk about quickly. There was an article that was shared in a labor newsletter. The headline is "Pierre Poilievre is popular among union members. What's it really all about?" This, the author's name is Chris Fairweather. He's a PhD student at McMaster in labor studies, and I guess he's making the link that there's this, some kind of that the reason basically behind labor support at the sort of membership level, obviously not at the political institutional level, but in terms of the membership, why are union members in favor of the Conservative Party at this point? I mean, there's this that this survey was released, what was this, in February, end of February. But basically, they've lapped the Liberals, and they're far ahead of the NDP among public sector and private sector union members. And he sort of makes the link that there's a kind of labor protectionism, labor nationalism that goes hand in hand with whatever you want to call Poilievre's more right-wing nationalism and protectionism. So I found this article sort of extremely dubious in terms of its arguments. Let me just read for you radio listeners some of the what I think are terrible arguments. The section labor movement nationalism, he says, in practice nationalism has taken many forms in the labor movement, including Buy Canadian campaigns, opposition to free trade, and suspicion of US-based international unions in Canada. So opposition to free trade is nationalism. I mean, I guess you can make that argument. Is it a bad nationalism? I can't think of any reason why working people wouldn't want to oppose free trade. I mean, this is kind of like a bit of a stretch to me. The idea that people wouldn't want to protect their jobs that are threatened by free trade agreements. I mean, try and sell that as a left-wing agenda in Southern Ontario. I don't know what kind of argument that is.
No, I mean, it's kind of I mean the thing is that if you think about the movement 20 years ago, and I mean this is a political tinted movement, right? Like 20 years ago, unions that was part of a radical progressive agenda were anti-free trade, right? We were defending the fight against, free trade, right? And that it wasn't free trade, it wasn't about trade at all, but it was about capital flight, corporations being able to maximize to lower wages, to threaten unions. And it wasn't nationalism, right? And it was from a stance of solidarity that this was going to hurt working people in Mexico and in Canada, right? And that this was essentially a point of corporate greed. And I think that it's a wrong starting point to say that all of a sudden to be defending agreements like NAFTA all of a sudden our way of fighting nationalism. Actually, you're just gonna feed into it, right? Because it's just then the right wing is the sole political voice that's challenging sort of this corporate greed, right? Like that's ridiculous. That's like I mean it's not a progressive stance, and it's back and shows like the weakness of the labor movement, right? So as opposed to there are things that are happening from below, right? There's been initiatives by Unifor, unions in Mexico, United Electrical Workers in the US, to say, no, we need like a NAFTA from below. We're going to have a workers' solidarity project, an intercontinental, right, to demand certain wages to limit the power of capital, right? Like that, like, so this idea that it's like, it's simplistic. I mean, of course, it's political posturing by people like the, you know, Poirier and whatnot, but the problem is that that doesn't mean as radicals or progressives that it's like simply what they're arguing against is like all of a sudden is the progressive position, right? It's like, no, ours is against, you know, those policies, and then from a basis of solidarity, right? Because it's not, it's clear what NAFTA did to Mexico, right? It's clear what NAFTA did, you know, even if you look at where that base of nationalism is, right? If you look at auto, if you look at like heavy manufacturing, right? Essentially, what it's done is essentially it's only moved, you know, assembly, light work, extremely lower paid. You know, it's hurt indigenous Mexican auto industry or manufacturing as well. So this idea that you know, those jobs, you know, like that protecting those jobs is somehow going to be, I think that's the best way to undermine a sort of a right-wing nationalism, right? Is it's that's the role of the left, right? Like that people feels right to continue their livelihood against corporate greed, and if plants are going to close because of that, you know, then it's like, well, okay, we can produce other things with infrastructure that's there around us, right? But yeah, no, I think the starting point of that kind of analysis is definitely it's off. And that's my hot take.
Well, just to wrap up this segment, let me just read the last two paragraphs. After all, how can unions frame their work as being primarily about defending Canadian interests without leaving their members vulnerable to appeals by populists about what those interests look like and how to advance them? Okay, let me just stop there. If you think that people can't understand the defense of Canadian interests as a class interest, then you've already lost, okay? If you can't explain to people that they have an interest in having good jobs, good wages, producing useful material for the consumption of people like them, if you can't frame that as being in opposition to the agenda of the ruling class, you're finished. That's a baseline politic. And the fact that academics can't figure that out just shows how bankrupt their notions of the labor movement are. You know, second paragraph, the last paragraph, the goal of the labor movement is to advance the interests of workers everywhere. Simplistic narratives about defending Canada might be expedient in the short run, but in the long run, they have likely done more harm than good. That's crazy. That's totally insane. This is really into hot take territory, but this stuff makes me so angry because I'm like, yes, we want to advance the interests of workers everywhere. But who are the workers whose interests aren't advanced by opposition to free trade, by opposition to taking the jobs that people have fought for, the contracts that they've fought for generations, just shooting those jobs away and saying you should be happy because now, like, now you can be in solidarity with workers in Mexico who are making cars for GM. That's just crazy to me. It doesn't make any sense. The fact that this person is saying that the narrative around free trade that was coming from the labor movement was simplistic rather than like a fight for survival on the behalf of communities that had a very proud tradition of fighting for workplaces that didn't kill them anymore, that didn't maim them anymore, that they were able to send their kids to school, that they had pensions that were worth fighting for, that this did more harm than good. It makes me want to shoot myself. Anyways, it's crazy that this is the level of discourse I mean, and again, like, I'm not like, I don't want to take all of this out on the poor Chris Fairweather, who's just trying to do a PhD at McMaster, but I think this just shows to me the sort of political immaturity and the lack of class understanding. And if you don't have like a basic class understanding and you're at the School of Labor Studies, then you need to back up a little, I think, because you should do that. Like, you're a PhD student, you should do that. Your advisors, they should be doing that. This is a class question, okay? So you need to be able to talk about that. The question of class doesn't really come up in this entire article. You talk about internationalism, you're not even talking about class. What's the basis of your internationalism if it's not class? Tell me this. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that it's clear that like these corporations, it's like yeah, it's simply starting from a, I mean already yeah, but the fault line is it's starting from a national perspective, right? These corporations don't think in a national perspective. Capital doesn't think in a national perspective. So yeah, but the question of class is on a national perspective too, right? And that so then yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think unfortunately that this perspective might be a bit on the simplistic side. That's
Break.
so we're gonna go to some music and then we'll be back in a few minutes. You're here on Labor Radio, here on CKT 90.3 FM.
Okay. Let's see this. I mean, we already did academics, I guess, to a degree, but we can come back to it if you want to talk more about this.
What time are we at? What's the run?
Just letting it run. Unmute.com. Okay, is that probably good?
So in wait, it's not, is it? It's not. Oh, maybe it's like.
Is it on now?
Hello?
Okay.
Hello?
I hadn't muted it. Okay.
Okay. So welcome back to Labor Radio here on. Welcome back to Labor Radio here on No Vax. Welcome back to Labor Radio here
None.
on CKUT. What's happening?
Okay, which one is mute? Is this mute? No. Is this mute? No. Neither of them is mute. I don't know. Check, check, check. This seems to be working. But check, check. Check, check. They seem identical, so I don't know.
Okay. And we're going to come back to you and talk about a more local affair, but it's kind of representative of the state of affairs within the labor movement currently, which has been recently at Concordia University. There has been a change of unions, over 1,000 research assistants and TAs who were formerly organized with the Public Service Alliance of Canada, the TRAC Union, have now become affiliated with CSN and has changed its name to the CREW Union, the Concordia Research Education Workers Union. And it kind of highlights particular issues and sort of stance, in terms of the question of rating, union democracy issues, again, how do people relate within the unions and and so we're this is our hot take on that issue. And again, if this is our personal views and not representative of any larger organization, so take that with also a grain of salt.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, some thoughts that I had about this, like, straight off the hop, was first of all that, I mean, workers are entitled to change their union affiliation, okay? That part is not under discussion here. The question then becomes, how do unions deal with that? Because, I mean, rating is part of the reason why Unifor is not a member of the Canadian Labour Congress right now. Currently, the Canadian Labour Congress has their convention in less than a month, and on the table is a resolution condemning actually the CSN about their raids of corrections officers in the provincial systems outside of Quebec. This is like a sort of explosive issue. I don't think that the question of the Concordia local is as explosive for the movement as a whole as what led to Unifor leaving the CLC. I'm not trying to make that comparison, but it's just useful context because I guess it did come sort of on the heels of this change of affiliation came on the heels of this big PSAC strike. I mean, so strategically, you might say it would have made sense that PSAC couldn't really dedicate that much resources to this raid. Doesn't really matter in the end. I personally feel like there's a lot too much. I mean, the nature of universities is that they write too much about themselves. And so this, I think, bleeds into the labor movement when it concerns universities. Like, teachers' assistants, research assistants, they're not going to be the backbone of any labor movement. It's okay. They're doing something that they're entitled to do. They're doing work and they should have the right to unionize. Again, not putting that into question. I'm putting into question, I guess, like how much energy that they might suck out of a labor movement that they might not contribute a ton to. And this is the case with most workplaces that are extremely transient by their very nature, is that they tend to not be like a bedrock of engagement with the wider movement. So research assistants and TAs tend to be like sometimes politically interested, and this might probably be the reason behind the move, because PSAC is not really considered like a very progressive union, or like a militant one, I should say. Progressive maybe, militant no. And so maybe they wanted to be part of CSN, some members of the executive, because they wanted to be members of the CSN, and that's all there is to it, you know, which is not really like a great reason to create friction between two very big organizations that have like sort of bigger fish to fry. That's like the very short version of my mini hot take.
No, I mean, I think for me, it's similar. Also, too, the problem where we're beginning to see a lot of, you know, when there's frustrations with larger unions, and I don't think those frustrations go away when the union actually changes hands. Of course, the larger structure or how it actually, you know, those larger structures, whether it be dealing with the national, dealing with the way that unions are structured. I mean, the question always, again, goes back to how are you organized within your union, right? Like, how is, are you blaming someone else for your own problems, right? And that is the question, because I think, you know, especially in the university sector, there is a lot of, you know, wiggle room. You know, I worked for another PCC local where we did go on strike, right? And it was undergraduates, you know, and there was internal outreach, you know, and there isn't that kind of stability, right? Because people, yeah, by the nature, are only there at these institutions for like a year, 2 years, you know, four if you're an undergrad. But The question is, the question is, what kind of organization do you have within your union, right? And again, are you really able to reach out to your members? Are you able to connect with the local membership? Are you building that, from the ground up, where members actually have a real voice over that decision making? And I know it's frustrating in those transient places, because you're going to put in all this effort to try to find desperate members who work from home, who work very casual. But I think that's an internal strategic question, right? That it could be easier to blame, the bigger institution or the parent union than it is on your own local organizing strategy.
Well, on that note, I mean, this has been just a vast array of lukewarm and hot takes. Thanks for being with us in our guestless episode. We're going to have a quick music break and be back to say goodbye.
And welcome back to Labor Radio here on CKUC 90.3 FM. And just before we go, just a couple of announcements. The first being that May Day is close upon us. So there's the demonstration on Monday, May 1st, 5 p.m.
Metro Valdez.
Metro Verdun. And then before that, there's two events you should check out. Not going to lie, they're happening on the same night. Myself and my co-host Stefan are involved in organizing. You should go to both, and then that way you maximize great food that evening. So I'll let Stefan talk about May Day at the Greek Workers Center.
Yeah, May Day at the Association of Greek Workers. That is April 29th, just like IWC. April 29th, Saturday. At 7 p.m. at our building, 5359 Park Avenue. We'll have music, food, and speakers from the labor movement and progressive movements.
And on April 29th, also same night, starting at 5 p.m. at 7000 Park, we're going to be holding our May Works Festival. So it'll be dinner, cultural performances by different groups of migrant workers like Migrante. So please come by, check it out, and please check out both.
Yeah, so that's been our episode for April. Thanks so much for listening, as always. And just a reminder that you can find us on Facebook, look up Labor Radio. Find us also every third Thursday of the month here on CKUT 90.3 FM between 5 and 6 p.m. and at the Labor Radio Podcast Network. So thanks for listening.
And have yourselves a wonderful May Day, and come out and enjoy all the different struggles.
Join us for the Montreal book launch of We Go Where They Go, the story of anti-racist action, on Saturday, April 22nd at 7 p.m. at Comité Social Sans Pursuit, 1710 Beaudry Street. Speakers will include three of the co-authors, a former ARA member who was active in Minneapolis, Detroit, and Chicago, the former coordinator of Montreal and McGill ARA, and a former member of Edmonton Anti-Fascist League. There will be cheap and delicious food served by Food Against Fascism and Sans Taverne beer on tap. We Go Where They Go recounts the thrilling story of a massive forgotten youth movement that set the stage for today's anti-fascist organizing in North America. At ARA's height in the 1990s, thousands of dedicated activists in hundreds of chapters joined the fights, political and sometimes physical, against Nazis, the Ku Klux Klan, anti-abortion fundamentalists, and racist police. Based on extensive interviews with dozens of ARA participants, We Go Where They Go tells ARA's story from within, giving voice to those who risk their safety in their own defense and in solidarity with others. Mark your calendar for what promises to be a fascinating evening of anti-fascist history and discussion.
Not getting paid enough to do this, but I don't look too bad, you know.
Nous avons ici une pièce de merde. Cette connerie dégoulasse, dégoûtante.
Well, anyway, this piece of shit over here is something I have been seeing in the airports wherever I go. It is from the, what is it, Musique Victime magazine, Spin. Or shall we say the fashion music magazine, Spin. Anyway. Ici nous avons United Colors of Benetton. While we have a picture of a boy who's dead and whose father is crying over him and whose mother is crying and his sister is crying because he just died of AIDS. And this is in Spin magazine. And it says here, United Colors of Benetton, our spring-summer 1992 edition of Colors magazine is now available at Benetton stores.